This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Who are you in cyberspace? Is the net changing how we interact with one another? Today on the Afternoon Magazine, our monthly discussion, Computers and You. Our topic today, the psychology of the Internet. Our guest is Dr. Patricia Wallace. She is head of Information Technology and Distance Education Programs at the Center for Talented Youth at Johns Hopkins University. She earned her PhD in psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. She also holds an MS in Computer Systems Management from the University of Maryland. Dr. Wallace is also the author of the book, The Psychology of the Internet. The book is published by Cambridge University Press. Listeners, I encourage your questions and comments about the Internet. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Wallace, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
The online environment is different from other settings where we come in contact with one another. What are the critical differences from the online world and real life?
Well, there are actually several, but some of the most important are, for example, the psychological distance. When you're communicating and interacting with people from your computer, your sense of closeness to them is very much diminished in many ways. You feel more empowered to say some of the things that you'd like to say, but on the other hand, you don't have the same inhibitions that you might have if you were face-to-face with them. So it creates a very interesting environment that I think alters our behavior.
Mm. So we're likely to behave differently online than in the real world.
Well, we do behave differently online. There's been considerable research on this now. One thing that happens, for example, is disinhibition. People are more willing, as I said, to say things online, and often those things that they say can be misinterpreted because so many of the cues that are critical to communication, the nonverbal cues, are absent when you move into the online environment.
Hmm. Well, we all know about flames and pointed email messages. We've also heard about people who meet and fall in love on the Internet. What is it about the net that, you know, encourages or allows all that passion to come through?
Well, in some respects, this is the other side of the disinhibition coin. When people are more willing to express negative feelings in an online environment, they're often more willing to express positive feelings and disclose intimate details about their lives that they would feel more inhibited about expressing if they were face-to-face with that person.
Hmm. It's interesting to think that about the net in terms of, we think of it both as fraught with some danger, but also a relatively safe place to be.
Many contradictions like that, yeah, related to the Internet. It's a new environment, and we're still making a lot of blunders when we interact inside of it. I know so many people, for example, who have sent out an email, even to someone they know personally, that was grossly misinterpreted, that the recipient perceived as being quite abrupt and aggressive, but the sender never meant it that way.
Yeah. In the book, you write about something that is called emotional intelligence. You point out that our emotional intelligence online is less acute. What is emotional intelligence?
It's a sensitivity to the nuances of a situation that go beyond the rational and the analytical. Most of the cues that we pick up along these lines really are nonverbal in nature. They have to do with the subtleties of muscular tension and posture, or the tone of voice, or the pace at which another person is speaking, or the facial expressions and eye contact and personal space. All of those things have nothing to do with the actual words that a person is speaking, but they very much affect the tone and the message that's being delivered. And emotional intelligence has to do with how acutely you are able to interpret those kinds of nonverbal messages.
Hmm. How far have emoticons gone, and the shorthand we might use online, for example, BTW, by the way, or in my humble opinion, or for what it's worth, and also the use of uppercase and lowercase, how far have those gone toward smoothing the pointedness of communication on the internet?
Well, in some respects, it's a case of human ingenuity. When we take a QWERTY keyboard that has nothing but ASCII characters and a few symbols, and try to mimic the richness and complexity of face-to-face communication using them by adding little smiling faces or dot dot dots and all sorts of things. Try to enrich that conversation. Now, the truth is, it only goes so far, and often it makes things worse. For example, if you're saying something that is somewhat critical or negative, and then you add a smiley face at the end of it, many people will interpret that to be sarcasm.
Right. As time goes on now, and we have more experience with the internet. Is our online emotional intelligence improving?
I think it is. I think we're all getting a little bit better, particularly from learning from the mistakes that we make. For example, when we contact a stranger online, mm-hmm. we don't just fall back into the typical email patterns of being very informal. Email is usually very informal. But when we contact a stranger, to use that level of informality does not seem appropriate. Mm-hmm. And people are learning not to do that. They're also learning things about the length of the message is important. That is, because when you compose a message and you're delivering a message, you can make it as long as you want. You're sitting there and you can talk as long as you want without interruption. Through typing,
right,
and then click the send key. But increasingly, I hope at least, people are becoming more sensitive to the fact that an email message is not the same as conversation, and people really don't want to hear you go on for page after page of stream of consciousness.
Yeah, you got to find just the right balance, so it's just right. I suspect that Marshall McLuhan would have called the net a hot medium, because it's not passive, it really involves us. Is that why it is so compelling? Is that why we are so drawn to it?
Well, I think it's there are a number of reasons why we're drawn to it. One is simply the interactivity that you can send a message and click send so quickly and get a message to another person literally within seconds. The internet has gotten better and better in terms of its infrastructure, so the interactivity is very high. So that, I think, makes it compelling. Simply the immediate reinforcement that you get by knowing that message was delivered, and if someone responds right away, the reinforcement's even higher. And that makes it more interesting than, for example, snail mail or even phone tag, where you could spend day after day trying to finally get in touch with another person. But there are other reasons why I think the internet, especially certain corners of the internet, have become particularly compelling, that have even created behavioral problems, that where people seem unable to get offline and get their regular work done.
Yeah, it can be addictive. Although, you know, this is an interesting question you raise in the book. Is it an addiction? Is it a disorder? You know, what is it? How should we think about it if we're spending too much time online?
Well, I'm not comfortable using the A word
right.
At this point in time, because I think it's premature, and we do have a tendency to pathologize too many things, in my view. But there's no question that there are some aspects of the internet that are so compelling that they contain all the ingredients that cause people to just stay with them over and over and over and for just long, long periods of time. And a lot of those have to do with the reinforcement schedules. That is, if you have a very cleverly designed intermittent reinforcement schedule that gives people, and it doesn't necessarily have to be money or anything like that, it can be just social rewards or just interaction. It has this tendency to keep people there all the time. And when the internet first started, when we first started looking at this, it was primarily the for example, the chat rooms and the synchronous multi-user games that were attracting so many users for extended periods. But then other kinds of things came out, such as the online auctions and the online gambling casinos, things like that, that are just as compelling and cause significant overuse.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one. Let's go and talk with this caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just had a comment. I was wondering if you'd experienced or could talk a little about this. I think one of the huge benefits of email and huge sort of addictive qualities of it is that it is instantaneous, like you say, practically, and it's also free. And the same with the internet, it's practically free. I mean, you pay a local telephone charge, but people can sit there for hours. It's cheaper than going to the movies, probably. And nowadays, you can watch movies. But one of the things I encountered in a company that I used to work for here in town, a maker of software, which I think is kind of like the bane of our existence as far as email is concerned, is that, it's well documented that people don't write letters anymore, and they don't write as well, I think, on email, tend to be terse and almost rude in situations. But I found also that it's a great way to avoid any kind of interaction and, to a certain extent, accepting any kind of responsibility for a task or a process or whatever. You know, you send someone an email to do something, and they can sort of send you a one-line response or pass it on. And nobody wanted to meet face-to-face to work out problems. And I would call people and say, look, this is something that we could work out in 5 minutes. And they would say, send me an email. And I said, well, if I send you an email, you'll send me a one-line response, or you'll bump it to two or three other people, and we'll get in this sort of endless loop, and 2 weeks will go by, and the problem will still exist. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe comment on that. Thanks.
I think you're making a very good point, that people have, in many cases, substituted email for communication strategies that should work much better, and a lot of the people who do this are not that comfortable dealing face to face with others in the first place, and because conflicts can arise and you have to have immediate answers, you don't necessarily have the opportunity to edit your comments or think through what you're going to say, that kind of thing. So that spontaneity is certainly adrenaline producing, but it can also be very stressful when you're in a face-to-face setting. Mm-hmm. Another thing that you didn't mention, but I think has also happened in organizational settings, is the tendency for people to CC a lot of other people, which makes it actually difficult to get your own job done. When you're constantly in a barrage by emails that are in principle, or at least in supposed to be helping to keep you informed, what is happening is you're being over-informed. And that issue of accountability that you just brought up, I think, is therefore dispersed. When you CC a lot of people about a project, for example, by trying to keep them informed, you're also dispersing accountability for that project. And I think that has caused some productivity issues in the workplace as well.
Yeah. It's interesting to think that over the years, with email, we're sort of being memoed to death.
Yes.
You know, and before, you know, you'd get memos, but, you wouldn't have 47 of them within the space of a day.
It's true. And sometimes they're... The email messages that we receive are these bizarre amalgamations of forwarded pieces and cuts and pastes and all sorts of things that would be totally unacceptable in a memo form, because they do nothing to synopsize the situation or to clarify anything. It's just, I just want to keep you informed by forwarding you these last 20 emails.
Thanks, but I don't need that level of detail. Something that I have noticed in my own life, online world has had an impact on my life, is in terms of my level of patience. I know that the WWW has also been referred to not only as the World Wide Web, but also as the World Wide Wait. However, online, I mean, I have so much, I have access to so much, and so with such great speed, that if something takes a little long to load, or I can find myself getting quite impatient. And I wonder if this spills over into our lives offline, that we expect things to be faster and faster and faster.
I think it's there isn't much research on this, and we need some, frankly. But one of the things that I think is happening is that people are gravitating towards a higher cognitive load, and because we can do multitasking on the internet, and because we expect information to be at the fingertips all the time, most people are keeping many windows open at the same time. And then when it carries over, it carries over in one way as the cognitive time slicing, where when you do have a down period, such as you're waiting in line or something like that, and there's not enough cognitive stimulation, people are devising strategies to make that happen, everything from wireless palm devices to cell phones to little games, so that we're always very sensitively adjusting this cognitive load upward.
Yeah, it also allows us to opt out of the physical world in a way, whether it be the cell phone or the Palm Pilot. We can sit in a very crowded space and be off in our own world.
Yeah, into the virtual world. There's a sense of control here. That is, that when you're in a situation, you have control over the interactions you will experience. And the wireless devices in particular give you a lot of ability to control those things. But on the other hand, they also raise the ante in terms of how we use our time. I think many people are increasingly dissatisfied when their cognition is not from boredom. They get bored more easily because they don't have enough to think about or to do or to accomplish.
Yeah, so we're hooked on stimulation.
Yeah, and increasing levels of it.
Yeah. Last weekend I was in Chicago, and I was in a shopping center, a mall in the city, and the those little billboards that they have within a shopping space, they were changing electronically very quickly. I mean, it was like you pull down a shade and let it snap. And I had never seen that before. And I think it gets back to this idea that we are always looking for something, some kind of, stimulation. It's like a candy.
You wonder how effective all that's going to be. I've seen some data to show that people are experiencing several thousand advertisements a day, many of which are on the web, but also on the displays that you're describing. How effective can all of that be?
Yeah. Something else I've noticed on the web lately is that there seems to be advertising that is more aggressive. It pops up at you and flashes, and even if you try to close the window, they pull you in to another level of that particular gimmick.
Well, there is a certain race on the web to develop, first to deal with that issue of the number of advertisements people are seeing, so that in order to try and capture attention, increasing level of commitment to grabbing an end user's attention, regardless of whether that end user might feel positively or negatively about it. As long as they can grab your attention and hold on to a piece of your screen for some period of time, there's a success level there.
Yeah. Well, it used to be you could more easily ignore all the advertising on the web, but that is becoming more and more difficult, I think.
No, it's true. And, technologically, they're doing things like pushing out pop-up windows and opening windows where you can't use the back key anymore, that kind of thing.
Yeah. You quote Karl Marx in your book, and I'll tell listeners here that how you quote him. You say the handmill gives you society with the feudal lord, the steam mill society with the industrial capitalist, and the point you make is that technologies have a great power to shape us, our behavior, and our social structures. We've been talking here a little bit about how they're shaping our behavior, but what about larger social structures? Are we seeing a reshaping of social structures as a result of the Internet?
Oh, I think so, and I think we're just at the beginning of that. Part of it is globalization. That is, a lot of what the Internet has accomplished in terms of breaking down barriers across the oceans and between countries is running into the what can only be described now as antiquated laws and contractual regulations and so forth that are dependent on geography, that were built up over millennia because people live geographically in certain spaces. And with the Internet able to enabling, empowering people to communicate and trade digital wares and so forth so easily across those geographic boundaries, we're running into a lot of conflicts about that.
Hmm. Patricia Wallace is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. She is head of Information Technology and Distance Education Programs at the Center for Talented Youth at Johns Hopkins University. She is also the author of The Psychology of the Internet. That is our topic today here on the Afternoon Magazine in this portion of the program. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we invite your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Another listener is waiting to talk with us, this one in Eureka on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Another very interesting discussion. A report came out. I realize one has to be careful of generalizations. Maybe you could just give me your specific observations and the world in which you inhabit, that stated that the Internet was leading to more social disconnection and avoidance, and I realize you touched on it, a lot of television watching that critics have comments have made. I wonder, do you share any of these same conclusions?
That's a good question. There's some good evidence that the more people use the Internet, the more disconnected they become from their family and friends. It looks as though, and this is especially at high levels of Internet use, where they're online for long periods of time, they are establishing weaker links with a kind of virtual community at the expense of the strong ties that they might have had with their family and friends. So there is some evidence for that. Not everyone completely agrees that that's happening. A lot of people look at it, see lots of examples in which people, such as those in support groups, find tremendous help from their online contacts that they could not get in a face-to-face world from their family and friends. So they can discuss very stressful and intimate issues at great length online with people who share them, regardless of where they are geographically.
So
we see both sides.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
I thought you made a very interesting comments at the beginning. You were talking about how being online sort of tends to, I guess the way I would say it, to turn off our general inhibitions we have about things.
Right.
That would account for some of the, illegal, one hears about people finding each other online. It just seems to me people with just total absence of common sense.
Well, you know, a part of it is it's the when you combine psychological distance with at least the perception of anonymity, or at least relative anonymity, those are powerful combinations, and people behave differently when they're in that kind of setting. It's the difference between someone who goes in, as an example, someone who is in a car and gets very angry at someone who doesn't signal when they make a turn and goes into a rage when they'd never expressed that kind of behavior to someone they knew.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Another listener is waiting to talk with us in Chicago on line one. Good afternoon.
Thank you. It's a wonderful program. In a certain sense, what happens with children and a lot of adults is that they become a form of roadkill on the information highway. And to the extent that they relate so much and are unable to relate in personal, physical, eye-to-eye contact is one of the offshoots of not having whatever guidance that they can have from parents. Or I'm thinking of schools like the Montessori, the Waldorf School, and others that try to encourage physical, active, and sensorial development before they get into much of the reading, writing, and other learning. But when they're so engrossed, as somebody paraphrased it, they become a form of roadkill on the information highway. And but however, something that you raised a little while ago, Celeste, was about structural change. And we can see all kinds of change occurring via the assembly line and the robots that are occurring and displacing human beings to the point where people are actually getting wired so that they can maintain contact. So we're certainly going to see structural changes occurring that we barely dreamed of in past times. But I'm reminded of something that Buckminster Fuller said, was asked one of his last interviews, I think, on the Larry King Show. He said, what would you like to see occurring in your lifetime or for everyone? He said, everyone should be able to have access to a telephone, and certainly the Internet is facilitating that. So I really enjoy your comments and everything so far, and I'm going to certainly get your book.
Thank you. You made some interesting comments yourself.
Patricia Wallace is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about her book, The Psychology of the Internet. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I want to go back to something that we were talking with our caller from Eureka about, and that is the idea of anonymity on the net. Cameras and microphones are now available and have been for some time. Are they changing the way we present ourselves to one another online?
They certainly have that potential. One of the things that happened online at first, for example, when we started building online work groups, is it leveled the playing field. The people who had advantages in a face-to-face environment because of their status or their height or their good looks or their commanding voice lost all that. And the people who were shy and not very attractive but who could write thoughtfully and well gained a certain amount of power and influence. Now, if you add the visual component again, if you bring that back into the equation, it'll change things again. So we'll probably lose, if people use it, we'll lose some of those status equalization effects that we've seen online in, for example, work groups.
I wonder how popular those cameras and microphones are, how many people are using them of all the people that are online.
Well, right now, most of them are pretty ghastly because the bandwidth's not there. Most people spend a lot of time losing connections or watching choppy images.
Yeah.
Another interesting piece, though, is that most of the software defaults so that when you're trying to communicate with an internet-based interactive video arrangement, it shows your own face right on the screen. Now, this is not analogous to a face-to-face setting. You don't usually have a mirror right there so that you can see what you look like when you're talking to another person. And that makes people very self-aware and concerned about the impression that they're making, more so than they would ever be if they didn't have that mirror in front of them.
What are your thoughts about sites that feature someone's life right there in their own home. You may see them eating or sleeping, making love, reading the paper. What do you think about that? What's that all about?
Webcams. This is the extreme of that disinhibition. Those people stop noticing the webcam after a while. But they have the ability now to become an instant celebrity and on the entire planet. And just by putting a webcam and a 24/7, a display of what's ever going on in their room, even if it's usually nothing, which is, you know, what it usually is. And it's partly exhibitionism, but it's also the influence of that disinhibiting effect of the Internet, that people who would never just leave their picture window open
right.
would put the webcam in their corner of their room.
There's a chapter in the book on the online persona. How different or how similar is it likely to be from our real-life persona?
Well, that's a good question. Ideally, we'd want to make it pretty similar so that we could have a lot of integration between how we behave when we're interacting online. So we have a lot of integration, for example, between how we behave on the phone and how we behave in face-to-face. But often it's less online. Now, sometimes the online persona is a way for people to manage their impression in ways that they could never do face-to-face. They could become more outgoing, for example, and tell jokes and do things that they might be too shy to do. We see that in distance education classes, for example, where students who are usually pretty shy and sit in the back and never ask a question suddenly become very, very, very loquacious when they get online. And some of that carries over to their real life. They lose some of that shyness because they do get some rewards for asking questions and making comments. So that's good. And in other cases, though, the online persona is truly a new invention, and it becomes more of an identity experiment where someone gets online and completely changes who they are, either changing their gender or they're going into a completely different demographic age group or changing their profession or whatever. And part of that is, then we're really into deception.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of this crossover between identity experimentation and deception. And the people who do that, some of them are doing it just as a way to explore different identities. And others are doing it for gain. That is, they want to meet people of different ages or flirt with them or do all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
So it's a mix.
Yeah. We certainly have heard about the sexual predators who are out there, and that is clearly deception. But that experimentation that's going on, that role-playing that's going on, by and large, most of it harmless, do you think?
Well, I don't. It depends. I think people should be more concerned about it than they had been in the past. For example, when a man pretends to be female or a mm-hmm. female pretends to be a man, typically people react very negatively to the former, but not negatively to the latter. When a man pretends to be a woman, the questions always arise, why? In some cases, they learn a great deal about how people react to them when they say the same things, but the only thing you've changed is the gender. There have been cases, for example, in newsgroups where when a man says the usual things that he'd been saying, but then uses a female name, people react differently to him to that persona, much to his surprise. They for example, might react negatively if the contribution, the post to the group is very assertive. They might think it's an aggressive woman who's doing that, and not just a typical man. One of the things that happened when people were able to do this online is that it challenged a lot of the stereotypes and. Some people gained a better understanding of some of those gender stereotypes were quite real.
Yeah. How common is gender swapping online?
Well, the data we have, I mean, we'll never get perfect data, but
right.
For example, in the gaming worlds, it looks like about maybe 15% of the people who are actually male will pretend that they're female. And there are a lot of reasons for doing that. One is just for more social interaction or to get more help, because a lot of the games are younger kids, you know, teenagers and young adults who are getting online, and they're more willing to help a female than they would be to help a male.
Hmm. Are people likely to change their online persona from one online space to the next, one chat to the next?
Yes. Many people actually do that. And again, it has a lot of it just has to do with experimentation, in my view, that people are trying out different roles. The adolescent period had typically been a space where people were supposed to be trying on different roles, but suddenly the internet came along and people had an opportunity to go online and to try out roles throughout their lives, and I think quite a number have taken advantage of that.
Yeah, I suppose it also is like in the real world. You behave differently in a business meeting than you do at the beach or in a nightclub.
You're absolutely right. And that's why I think it was so important to take a look at this as an environment,
mm-hmm.
and to say that, no, it's not that the Internet is populated by very strange or disordered people when we saw strange things happening. We needed to take a look at the environment and how that might be drawing out different kinds of behavior in people.
Let's talk with another listener in Urbana, Line 1. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I've got a couple of quotes. One isn't very isn't verbatim, but it had something to do like it was a Confucian quote, and it said that if a person talks about other people, stay away from him. If a person talks about events, listen to him, but if a person talks about ideas, follow him. And I think that what you touched on earlier, where there's a difference in in leadership because you're online, because you drop off all this exterior stuff, is a positive thing. Things like, for example, Arts and Letters Daily. Is you know, nobody expected that to be a popular website, but it really is, and people, you know, love talking about ideas, I think, much more than anybody would expect. And there's also that dimension that, and I've got a quote for this too. There's a quote by Gabriela Mistral, who was a Chilean poet, and she said, "Speech is our second possession after the soul, and perhaps we have no other possession in this world," unquote. And I think that speaks a real truth too, which is, you know, kind of been an idea that's been in the it has a long tradition, you haven't spoken yet about, and I'd like you to say something about the fact that at least on the internet, there's the possibility of having unedited communication, you know, and people are so tired of the highly managed news that we get in commercial broadcasts and all the attempts to get us to purchase products. It's just delightful to be able to talk about ideas and to be fairly sure that that you're getting information or you're getting communication that is normally, if not suppressed outright, at least, you know, ignored by the mainstream. I guess I'll hang up and let you respond. Thanks.
You made a couple of very, very important points, and the first one, I think, about the way that people will communicate with one another online, and I recall another way to express that is that when they meet and start discussing and sharing ideas with someone online, it feels as though they're getting to know mind to mind instead of face to face. And this is a new event for people. It can be very refreshing to push aside all of the the impression management and impression formation strategies that people have used for millennia and just go straight into the ideas. And I think people do find that both enticing and refreshing and a wonderful way to get to know another person. Mm. Now, on the other side, about the whole issue of communication of events and about the news, I think one of the things that the Internet has done is distribute power. No longer do the broadcast networks, for example, or the cable TV companies have such control over what information is passed around, and now people can start grassroots movements and counteract whatever news is being distributed. And it's happened over and over again. The Internet has played such an important role in the globe, in areas where news is particularly restrictive. Such, you know, when we saw things happening in Kosovo, for example, we saw a lot of Internet communication where news was being released just by the people who happened to be able to access an Internet connection. So I think when we were talking earlier about structural changes, this is a key one, that we've distributed power in a way that it's just in its infancy, and people are just learning how much power they really do have when they have an Internet connection.
Another thing I want to talk about before we go, this relates to the Internet and ideas, the world of ideas, is that you can find folks of the same mind as your own out there. You might be in a very tiny town and you have a particular interest or you have a particular idea. You can find someone of a like mind on the Internet, and this can be good and bad. Group polarization and extremism are out there on the Internet big time.
Yeah, you're quite right. We don't have that because we can go out on the net and reach out to people who, for example, have a rare disorder such as the same one we have. That's all those things are very positive. We can reach out to people who enjoy a certain kind of horseback riding that is not local to our geography. And all of those things are great. We can take distance education courses in calculus that aren't offered at the school that we attend. But on the other side, you can reach out to people who have extreme ideas. And when you said group polarization, when you do start reaching out in that fashion, those people tend to confirm and reconfirm their own beliefs. So they don't have that reality check of the people around them who, you know, say, wait, that idea is truly bizarre. Instead, what they're doing is just agreeing and forming a kind of groupthink so that they become more and more extreme.
Hmm. This is something interesting to think about as well. We think about the Internet so often as being wild and free, but apparently there is more pressure to conform in Internet groups than there is in the real world.
Well, it's hard to get people to conform online. So, one of the things that had happened, especially in the discussion forums, is that the moderators and the people who are trying to keep these groups going learned quickly that they had to use almost a sledgehammer to get people to behave and to stay on topic and to make valid contributions and not flame each other. So you see a lot of strong language and people correcting each other a lot in some of these discussion groups.
Mm, interesting. You are in information technology and distance education programs at Johns Hopkins. How is the Internet affecting education?
Oh, I think it's bringing wonderful things to education. First, certainly in access to online library materials that had been typically available only in local universities, that has made a huge difference. People around the globe can now access all kinds of library materials online. Another thing is access to tutors and education and specialized knowledge. I mentioned before, a student in a middle school who's particularly gifted can now take a calculus course, even if they don't have any teachers available. And that is a huge benefit, where people can actually take specialized courses that were not available to them anymore.
Is it affecting the process of learning?
I think it is. I think in some ways we're learning more about how people learn by virtue of figuring out what's good and what's bad about distance education. One of the things that people thought initially was that distance education would be just kind of an online self-paced course, and we could just hand it out and let people work through it. But in fact, some of the most most important component of distance education turns out to be interactivity with other students and with the professor and with the tutor or whoever you're working with. And all of those things were critical in the face-to-face world too, but in the online world, the interactivity takes center stage, so that the teacher is not getting up there and lecturing for 45 minutes and then allowing 5 minutes left over for the interaction. Instead, the teacher is saying, "Here, progress through this work, and now let's all talk about it." And so that 50 minutes is spent much more on interaction than it had been in the past.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Dr. Patricia Wallace has been our guest this afternoon. She's head of Information Technology and Distance Education Programs at the Center for Talented Youth at Johns Hopkins University. She is also the author of The Psychology of the Internet. The book is published by Cambridge University Press.